You're tuned to WSOU 89.5 from the campus of Seton Hall in South Orange. We are Quest Youth Radio, which is the best youth radio. Now, I want to say without any hesitation that this morning's show is going to be a little bit different than what we normally do. However, it stays within the line and boundaries, if I use that word, right, of what we normally do every week. And that's give you some type of comprehension of African-American history and what has taken place. And that's basically a lot of good stories and inventions and inventors. So without any further ado, I'd like our guest to come on to the mic, Mr. Larry Hamm, president of the People's Organization of Progress.
Good morning, Brother Bay. How are you? Good morning to the listening audience. I'm very glad to be with you early on Saturday morning.
Oh, yeah.
And let me say one more thing. Let me give a shout out to my friends here at Seton Hall. I've had a long association. Of course, Dr. Forrest Pritchett from the Africana Studies Program, and all the professors and staff. And also want to give a shout out to the students, Protect AFAM movement, and the Concern 44, who were engaged in a very righteous struggle to get more resources for the Africana Studies program here at Seton Hall University. And to you, Brother Bay, who I've known, oh my goodness, close to at least now over 35 years. You and I met, I think, after the Jesse Jackson campaigns.
Yeah, well,
in the 1980s.
I actually traveled down to Atlanta to support.
For the convention.
Yes.
The Democratic National Convention in 1988. Oh, my goodness. There must be people listening. It's like, in 1988, I wasn't even born yet.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to the point to where I had Run, Jesse, Run buttons.
Yes.
And a lot of people just don't know about that.
Yes.
That before there was an Obama, there had to be a Jesse.
There wouldn't have been an Obama if it had not been for the efforts of Reverend Jackson and all those that supported his two campaigns. Most people don't even know about one, but you know, it was two. He had one in 1984, where he did better than expected, and then one in 1988, where he almost got the nomination. So it was it is a part of our contemporary history that is worthy of serious scholarly examination. Hopefully some enterprising student will do a paper or two on it.
Right. Just to bring that into perspective. You know, we live in a society where people have we live in a society where people just doing gone bonkers, if you ask me, right? I think the point that I was really trying to make as I try to pull up my questions here is that a lot of people have what I learned is convenient amnesia.
Huh.
Okay. The things that the challenges and struggles that we have had to go through in order to, you know, just exist in American society. And, you know, it hasn't been. You know, it was very interesting when I met a Irish gentleman who talked to me about discrimination, and he was older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting when I spoke to an Italian gentleman who spoke to me about discrimination because of, you know, their ethnicity. And, you know, that's something that seems to kind of have moved on in society, but for African Americans, it just seems to stick.
Right, right. Well, for the students who may be listening, I want to recommend a book. Actually, it's a two-volume set. I believe the author was Paul Jacob, was his name. But the title of the two-volume work, which is very easy reading. I know as soon as I said two volumes, people freeze up, you know. But it's very easy reading. And the title was To Serve the Devil. And that was a set that I was introduced to as a student when I was a student at Princeton University. And each chapter of that book dealt with discrimination, ethnic or racial discrimination, and national, ethnic, racial, national discrimination that was visited upon different groups in American society. And this was when I was first at Princeton University, which was in 1971. And, you know, I lived about 3 miles down the road from Seton Hall University, maybe a little more than three. I lived on South 12th Street in Newark, New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
Which was, at that time, it was euphemistically called the inner city. And before that, it was called the ghetto. You know, I don't think those terms are very current anymore. But I grew up in a very, in a very segregated community. And all I knew was what was around me and what was said to me. And I knew, because by 1967, I was 13 years old. And when the rebellion, and we're coming up on the anniversary of the Newark Rebellion in just in less than 10 days, July 12th was the anniversary of the Newark Rebellion. I was almost 13 before my grandfather, who raised me like a father, because my father had passed away when I was 4 years old, started talking to me about race relations. And I know this may be hard for some people today to kind of, you know, understand, but I didn't come from like a politically active family. I didn't come from a family of protest, of people who engaged in protesting. I was like a family of working people. You know, my father was a truck driver until he died. My mother was a seamstress. She worked in the cleaners around the corner. And my grandfather was what they call a boiler man. He worked in a factory in Bloomfield, New Jersey. He was the man that would work in the basement and run these huge furnaces that boiled the water that was needed. He worked in what we would call today a recycling factory, but they didn't call it recycling back then. This is a factory that took all these cardboard boxes, which were used a lot before plastic became the order of the day, and they would turn those cardboard boxes into sheets of new cardboard. And he was the man that ran the boilers. And, you know, it was a kind of skilled job, because if you didn't have someone that knew what they were doing, they'd blow the factory up.
Right,
you know?
Because that's industrial.
Right. So it was the night of July 12th, and we're sitting on the porch. We lived in a three-family wooden frame house on South 12th Street between 16th and 18th Avenue. And we were literally watching the rebellion unfold before us. It had started two blocks down the street on Springfield Avenue. It started down like Springfield. It started in front of the 17th Avenue precinct. And as a result of a confrontation between protesters and police, because people thought the police had killed this black cab driver, John Smith. And it worked its way up Springfield Avenue. And then it worked its way into the communities, because unlike today, in the 1950s and 60s, business was decentralized. Like there was a downtown Newark, of course, that was the main business district, but almost every avenue, everything that was avenue, like today people talk about, I live on the number streets, you know, but the avenues were all commercial strips.
Right.
You know, I lived near the intersection of 12th and 16th Avenue, and on 16th Avenue, there was every store that you could imagine. You know, literally on the corner, there was a vegetable store. Like, most people don't even know what a vegetable store is, but it was a store. Before we had supermarkets, there would be a store that sold vegetables,
fresh,
and fruits.
Fresh vegetables.
That's right. And then across the street was the grocery store, and then on the other corner was the candy store, and the other corner was a gas station. There were two laundromats that did your laundry for you. There was a laundromat where you could do your own laundry. There was the drugstore, which was also the liquor store, you know.
Okay.
Shoe stores, clothing store, everything. You literally didn't have to leave the community if you didn't want to get what you needed. So the rebellion started on Springfield, but it spread throughout the community. And I'm asking my grandfather, and he starts talking to me about issues about race, talking to me about his experience in the Army because he was a veteran of World War I, you know. So I grew up, insular was the word I was grasping for. I grew up in an insular, in an all-black environment. I didn't know that other people experienced discrimination too. And that's what I learned when I took this class at Princeton as a freshman, and I had to read that book, To Serve the Devil, because it talked about, you mentioned the Italians, you mentioned
Irish.
You mentioned the Irish. I mean, we know about no colored allowed signs. There used to be signs up, no Irish and no dogs allowed. No Chinese and no dogs allowed. People don't know that, you know, Italian immigrants weren't even considered white at the beginning of the 20th century. You know, this idea of whiteness, you know, was something that began to develop, you know, in the 18th century.
Yeah, we call it here a construct,
right?
Something that was invented to keep the people divided.
That's right. It was race is a social construct that was developed fundamentally at the time of its development. It arose and grew and developed during the era of imperialism and colonialism, which is commensurate with the development of the transatlantic slave trade. And racism developed as an ideology to justify and perpetuate the enslavement of Africans. So whiteness was invented, and different white groups had to be absorbed over time into this white construct. And it took quite a while. And it wasn't just a kind of cultural absorption. It was also a legal absorption. There are famous cases that you can go to in each one of these areas where people actually sued for their whiteness. They went to court to have themselves proclaimed white so that they would not continue to experience the discrimination that they would experience. So to make a long story short, these other groups that you spoke of, the Italians, the whites, the Southern Europeans, and other even Eastern Europeans, you know, were, you know, gradually absorbed. But African Americans, for whom this racial ideology was developed to perpetuate our racial oppression, we're still not absorbed. In fact, these decisions that have come down from this ultra conservative right-wing Supreme Court majority over the past couple of years demonstrate what an ongoing dynamic this is, that in fact we have periods where it seems like we take, you know, two steps forward, and then there's a white backlash is what we used to call it, and then we take three steps back, you know. And we can see right now, literally before our very eyes, with this most recent decision of the court to do away with affirmative action in college admissions, that they are literally trying to deconstruct the progress that we made since the Brown versus Board of Education Topeka, Kansas decision in 1954. In fact, I would posit to many, and, you know, I'm willing to be challenged on this, you know, that this is the ultimate goal of this Supreme Court. is to revisit Brown. And what people, a lot of people can't grasp, because it's like this idea, it's not happening to me-ism. So as long as it's happening to other groups, you have this false sense of security that it won't happen to you. Because I know, you know, the idea of gay rights is still something that's controversial for some people. But I'm telling brothers and sisters out there, you think what they're doing with this most recent Supreme Court decision that set back gay rights. There were three major decisions the last couple of weeks. One was to end affirmative action in college admissions. The other one was to the court nullified President Biden's effort to reduce student loan debt. And the other one was a case that sanctions discrimination against gay people. And so people are saying, well, that's the gays, that's only... No, brothers and sisters. When the structure moves against one group, it sets a precedent that will enable it to move against another group. And one of the things that I would urge students to do is to familiarize themselves with the history of World War II. This is something that we really, you know, and you know, sometimes you got to go through a kind of a process and a step-by-step thing. You know, we struggle for Black studies and continue to struggle for Black studies because our history is not included, and we got to struggle to keep our history included in the curriculum. But Black studies and African studies is not all the studies in the world. You know, there are other types of studies that we have to do. You know, when I was a kid at South 17th Street School in Newark, they taught us a little bit about World War II. But the way the teachers taught it to us, it didn't feel like they were talking to me, about me, or talking in a way.
It definitely was missing something.
That's right. It was missing something. And I didn't understand it. But what happened during World War II in Germany has striking parallels to what is happening in the United States today. And just as I was saying a minute ago, how you move against one group, you know, to make it possible to get to the group you ultimately really want to get to. That's what happened in Germany. You see the same thing, you know, that this whole the gay rights question is not a new question. You know, there were gay people. There's always been gay people. There were gay people in Germany who had a certain degree in freedom. And then the Nazis came to power. They moved against the Germans, and they moved against this one. They moved again, and eventually they moved against the group, the Jews. Even against Catholics, even against socialists and communists. You know, many people think there were only Jews in those concentration camps. There was all kind of people in concentration camps, including Afro-Germans. Many people don't know that there was an African-descendant population in Germany. Germany had colonies in Africa. You know, we only think of the English and the Dutch and the French and the Portuguese. Germany had colonies and in fact committed horrific Holocaust against the Africans in what we call today Namibia, which used to be called Southwest Germany, and the Belgians committed against the Africans in the Congo. Tens of 10 million.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to reel you in, all right?
I'm sorry. I'm going far afield.
No, but that's good, right? Because the information that you are sharing is like, you know, something that people ignore. And you got me thinking. I was thinking a whole number of things, and that's why I prepared the questions. Which the first one, basically, you kind of touched on, and you dabbled there for a moment. And that is, what is the initial reaction to the recent affirmative action decision by the U.S. Supreme Court? And do you agree or disagree with the ruling, and why?
Oh, I absolutely disagree with the ruling, because this ruling is going to take away opportunities from current and future generations of young people that I had 50 years ago. Look, I just told you where I came from.
Princeton.
Well, I came from Newark.
South 12th Street.
South 12th Street, and I went where? To Princeton University. How did the son of a seamstress at the Hoffmanizing Cleaners on 16th Avenue in Newark, New Jersey, between 12th Street and 13th Street, how did that son get to go to Princeton University? Because there was something called the Civil Rights Movement, which fought against racial discrimination against black people, because a lot of these colleges and universities didn't even accept black people or only accepted a one or two or a couple of token black people, you know, for whatever reasons. And there was a civil rights movement which broke down the barriers of racial discrimination, which was successful in getting the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed. Part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was, I believe, Title VI, which addressed racial discrimination in education. That became the basis for affirmative action, complemented by the passage of the Higher Education Act of 1966, I believe, 65 or 66, which created financial aid. Because before 1965, there was no such thing as financial aid. There were, for education, there was only the GI Bill. And if you were in the Army, you could get a short-term loan. If you came home alive, and that was a big if, you know, if you came home alive, you could get a short-term, you could get a loan, low-interest loan to buy a house, or you could get some money to go to school. The Higher Education Act, in which Adam Clayton Powell played a major role in getting that passed, the Higher Education Act created financial aid programs. And that's how a lot of us, so two things had to happen. They had to break down the racial barriers so that these institutions had to bring in students of color and also poor students. You know, a lot of people think the biggest beneficiaries of affirmative action are black people. No.
You're wrong.
The biggest beneficiaries of affirmative action primarily were women, because it was more effective in addressing gender discrimination, particularly against white women. And it also helped a lot of poor white students who were able to avail themselves of financial aid, because even if there wasn't a racial barrier, you still had to pay for it.
Right.
And college was, you know, out of the reach of a lot of people.
And a lot of white people that lived in rural areas.
That's right.
Benefited.
That's right. So I am an affirmative action baby. I know it. I ain't ashamed to say it. You Negroes walking around here talking about you don't, nobody made a way, you made it on your own and all this other foolishness. No, you didn't. People that we don't even know put their lives on the line, went to jail, were killed, were tortured so that the civil rights movement could achieve its goal, pass the Civil Rights Act, and then out of the Civil Rights Act came these affirmative action programs. Look.
Question number two.
Okay.
Stay
on me, brother. Stay on it.
You kept on going, right? And you almost answered it. And I'm just going to say the question, because right. I know you touched it. How do you think this decision will impact the pursuit of racial equality and diversity in higher education institutions?
This decision of the Supreme Court that came out last week is going to cause an immediate decline in black student enrollment and enrollment of students of color on college campuses around this country. How do we know that? Because this was not the first case. This case that the Supreme Court ruled on just last week, was the latest in a long line of cases. Because from the point that Affirmative Action and Civil Rights Act was passed, people opposed it. Like, if I was to tell a student today, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, they would think, oh, the Congress came together and unanimously approved the Civil Rights Act. No. But one-third of the Congress voted against the Civil Rights Act. And from the point that it became law, it was passed a majority. They engaged in efforts to prevent its implementation. when Dr. King wrote his fifth book, his fifth of six books, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, he wrote that book in 1966. He said the country had already turned its back on the struggle for desegregation and the war on poverty. He wasn't even close to dead. And he could see already that the commitment was waning. So the big case came in 1972, the Bakke case.
Right, the Bakke decision.
The Bakke decision, which said affirmative action was
Reverse discrimination.
That's right, reverse discrimination. It did not end. So what you had from the Bakke case forward is a series of cases, each one weakening affirmative action, making saying that affirmative action programs had to be narrowly tailored, and with each case weakening more and more and more, and then finally the Republican right wing got enough strength that they have a supermajority now in the Supreme Court. You have six, the six that passed these most recent decisions were all appointed by Republican presidents. George Bush Sr. Appointed Clarence Thomas. His son, George Bush Jr., appointed two more. And then Trump appointed an unprecedented three. So now they had not just a majority on the court, a supermajority. They had enough strength to say, we're going to do away with it altogether. And that's what they did.
Question number three. In your opinion, does the decision align with the goals and principles of affirmative action? Why not?
No, the decision is antithetical. There's only one place where the decision, most recently made the Supreme Court, aligns with affirmative action, and that's in the military. They're like, okay, we're going to eliminate affirmative action everywhere except in military schools and institutions. So they sanctioned affirmative action if you're going to join the army and die on the battlefield, but we can't have affirmative action anywhere else in society. It's crazy. But the craziest part of it is not what they did, is that they're doing it before our very eyes with impunity because they have what? Because they have the power to do so.
So do you believe that affirmative action is still necessary in today's society? Why or why not?
Affirmative action is still necessary because racism, overt racism, covert racism, institutional racism, racial violence, racial discrimination, racial oppression, racial exploitation, all continue to exist in American society despite what that conservative, ultra-conservative majority on the Supreme Court says. And until racism, racial inequality ceases to exist, there will have to be affirmative measures taken to include those groups that are locked out through racial discrimination.
Now, what are some potential consequences and implications of this decision for the underrepresented communities in higher education?
Well, the consequences are going to be this, that students who might get an opportunity to go to college are not going to get that opportunity now. And we must not just talk about the affirmative action case, we must also talk about the ruling, which was in essence the Supreme Court legislating from the bench, which they said they would not do when these people were approved in the Senate hearings. They said they wouldn't do this, and they actually ended up doing it because it was their intent to do it all along. So now it's not just people are not going to be able to go because race can't be used at all as a factor in considering admissions. Now students who can't afford to go are not going to be able to go. And it's bigger than just colleges and universities. Look at all the students now who have student debt. And they don't have like $1,000 or a couple of thousand dollars in debt. They got $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 of debt. Some of them just for 4 years undergraduate education. This debt right now is the largest form of debt in American society, equaling some $1.4 trillion. And so a lot of these students, they're going to be living with mommy and daddy, and I'm not just talking about black, I'm talking about black, white, red, yellow, brown, I'm talking about all the students. You know, they're going to be living with mommy and daddy for years. They're not going to be able to afford to buy a house. A lot of them are not even going to be able to afford rent. They're not going to be able to buy a car. Because if you graduate from college and you get your first job, say, for instance, your actual take-home pay, the actual money you take home after they take out the fringe, the unemployment, the Social Security, and all that other stuff, you actually bring home $2,000 a month. Well, you got to pay the bank back, or you got to pay the loan agency back $1,200 a month. That leaves you $800. What can you do with $800? You can feed yourself, but that's about it. You can't pay rent anywhere for $800 a month. You're not in a one-bedroom apartment anyway.
I'm going to hold you up right there. Right, we're going to musically continue. You're tuned to Quest Youth Radio, which is the best youth radio. From the campus of Seton Hall in South Orange, the president of People's Organization of Progress, Mr. Larry Hamm. And when we come back, I want to know what motivates you to have been in this for over 50 years. Mm. And I'm so glad to have gotten you up this morning and got you so fired up, right? And the questions are working, right? But you working overboard. I want to know what motivates this brother. Musically, we continue. Don't you go anywhere. Keep it locked. More to come up. Okay, so, gosh, I just got finished making my little proclamation. So I like to know, what has motivated you to keep the energy going for so many years? You know, there's a level of inconsistency, and I got to keep on saying this, unfortunately. And I am not comparing people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, from my perspective and growing up and just seeing the disparities and being educated and being able to get financial aid to be able to attend Seton Hall University and graduate and have President Reagan come with Pearl Bailey in the 80s during the graduation ceremony, right? But also Judy Miller, Forrest Pritchett.
Oh, yes.
And being the teacher, one of the teachers for radio broadcasting for Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs.
Yeah, there you go.
Who's a grown man now, right? And I think I'm younger than him. but because he dates me with his, because he's the author now. A couple of weeks back, I reached out and spoke to him. But, you know, there's always been this thing where I felt that understanding your history, understanding who you are, and within perspective of the world, you could make a difference as an individual. And I'm doing all the talking. What motivates you? What has motivated you throughout all these years?
Well, that's a good question, and it's a question that is often asked. It's a question sometimes that I ask myself to try to collapse this into a manageable answer.
Okay, so let me
keep going here. I think fundamentally the values that my mother and my family instilled in me. Now, I mentioned a little while ago that I didn't come from like a political family, right? And that's absolutely true. Although my mother, one year I remember, she did run for district leader. And I think she may have served one term as a district leader, whatever that meant back in the 1960s when she was a district leader. And at that time, the chairman of the Central Ward Democratic Organization was a fellow named that they call Honey Ward. I think his name was Ulyss Ward, but Honey Ward was the black chairman of the Central Ward Democratic Organization. Remember, Irvine Turner Boulevard in Newark is named after Irvine Turner, who was the first black person ever elected to municipal government in Newark in 1960. Newark had been a predominantly black city for some time, but because of redlining and racial discrimination in housing, everybody was crowded into the Central Ward and lived either in the Central Ward or parts of the other wards that adjoined the Central Ward. And so around, you know, blacks began to push back. And I think one year, but my mother never talked to me about it. I know she ran for district leader, and I was happy when she got elected. You know, she won a little election in that district. And it's funny because the community that I lived in was in the Central Ward at that time. But right now, it's in the West Ward. Because as populations change, every time there's a census, they have to redraw the maps and the boundaries of election districts. So now I think the West Ward comes all the way down now to around South 10th Street, something like that. Goes all the way over. The West Ward used to start like at South Orange Avenue, and now it goes all the way over. But to answer your question, I think the values, the fundamental bedrock values that my family put in me, like to treat other people fairly, you know, religiously people would say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And my family wasn't a super religious family. Now, my grandmother and her sister, they went to church, and they lived, we all lived, like six of us, in a second floor apartment at 527 South 12th Street. So my grandmother and her sister, Joan, Stella Cobb and her sister, Joan Hill, they were members of Mount Calvary Baptist Church, where Reverend Mapson was the preacher. That church is still there on the corner of Hawthorne and Seymour. They were with Mapson when he started in a storefront church on Prince Street in Newark. So, you know, there was some religion, but my mother wasn't deeply religious, and my grandfather, he had an antipathy toward religion, as a matter of fact, and an antipathy toward racism. He told my mother, he said, when I die, don't put my body on the train and send me back to Georgia to be buried. He said, you put me on that train, you put my body on the train, I'm going to get up off the train, come back and beat you behind. My father experienced the worst of racism. I knew why. He was a tall, my grandfather was like 6'3". You wouldn't know it to look at me, right? He was a tall, black man in every sense of the word. I mean, he looked, you're talking about African-American, he looked like an African, you know, and he probably experienced the worst of racism. So the bedrock values, treating people fairly, the idea of sharing, you know, you learn that as a kid. So I think those values like that, and to be polite and to treat people nice, you know, and to help others who need help. You know, those were values that were put into me as a kid. So how did that become political? Well, I ended up going to Arts High School. My high school was supposed to be Westside High School, where I lived like, what, three blocks from Westside High School. And that's where I wanted to go, to Westside, because that's where all my friends went, and that's where my girlfriend was going, to Westside. So I wanted to go to Westside. Right, right. I got thrown out of school in eighth grade. I got in some trouble. My mother had to bring me back a week later, begged the principal to let me graduate, because they said I was so bad. The principal, whose name was Mr. King, by the way, and he wasn't Martin Luther King. He was a white Mr. King, told my mother that I was a common hoodlum, and they weren't going to let me graduate. And my mother cried. She begged that man in front of me to let me graduate. And that was a nodal point. That was a point where I saw that I needed to do better than I was doing. So I had a teacher, her name was Miss Ryerson, Elizabeth Ryerson, and she was white, very white. Like, she wasn't even from New Jersey. She was, like, from Connecticut or somewhere, you know, one of these white New England states. But she took an interest in me, and I remember one day, it was the end of the school day, 3:15, and I was getting ready to leave. She said, Larry, come here. I said, yes. She said, we're going downtown. I said, going downtown? First of all, ain't no white person ever tell me I'm going somewhere with them, right? Downtown? I said, I got to ask my mother. She said, we don't have time for that. Now, if that had happened today, Ms. Ryerson would have lost her job. She took me downtown Newark to Bamberger's. The building is still there. Bamberger's, what was Bamberger's department store? It's a big brown building.
Oh, yeah.
On Market Street. And between Halsey and Washington. And she took me upstairs to the top floor. And the top floor was where they sold toys and books. Went up there. It was a big commotion up there. First time I had ever seen television cameras, right? This was in the spring of 1967. And who was up there causing all this commotion? Jesse Owens. The Jesse Owens that had destroyed the myth of white Aryan supremacy in Berlin, Germany in 1936. This white woman had enough thought in her mind that she felt this was someone I needed to meet. And she pushed her way through the crowd. She got a book off the table because he was there to sell his autobiography. And on another day, we actually come back and talk about the Jesse Owens story, because that's quite some story. Before John Carlos and Tommy Smith, who raised their fists for black power in Mexico in 1968, there was Jesse Owens in 1936, you know. And I won't get into it because I'm tempted, but I'm not. I believe Jesse where he is. But she introduced me to Jesse Owens. And she introduced me because she wanted me to see this famous black champion of racial justice. Now, she didn't put it in quite those terms, but
be inspired.
But be inspired. So he signed the book for me, you know, and then she knew, Ryerson knew, that I could play the guitar. Now, I know you're not, people not going to like to hear this, but, you know, when I was a kid, Elvis Presley was all the rage, right? And I would see these movies with Elvis Presley, and I wanted to play the guitar. You know, people say, well, wasn't there somebody black? I didn't know nobody black. Well, I only knew Elvis Presley. So my grandfather, there was a sign maker. His shop was like on the corner, I think, of 6th Street and 16th Avenue. And my grandfather took me down there to do the man made signs during the day, and he gave music lessons at night in the back of his, in the evening, not at night, but in the evening, the back of his shop. My grandfather took me down there, and that man taught me how to play the guitar. Miss Ryerson said, I want you to take the test for Arts High. Now, they gave the test twice. I didn't take it in the fall because I didn't want to go to Arts High. I wanted to go to West Side. But now I'm trying to get my life in another direction. There wasn't Science High and University High and all these other high technology high. They didn't have that all back then. Right. Arts High was like, if you wanted to go to college, you had a better shot. You could still go to college, you went to other schools, but you had a better shot if you went to Arts High. And I went to Arts High, and you had to take all these tests, language, reading, math. I passed all the tests and the music because I could read music because I had learned, you know, music. And he didn't just teach me sound. He taught me how to read music, and I got in Arts High. Well, long story short, I became the president of the student government at Arts High. At Arts High, they didn't call it president, they called it mayor. The mayor of the student government at Arts High. And in 1971, there was this teacher strike. It was the longest teacher strike in the history of the country. And the rule was, the regulation was, if a student missed 35 days of school, they weren't supposed to get promoted, and they weren't supposed to graduate if they were in 12th grade. Now, here we had all these seniors, right? That had already, because this was in March, had already applied to colleges. Some of us had already been accepted. I applied to three colleges, Princeton, Harvard, Yale. I got accepted at all three. Mm. I chose Princeton because Princeton offered the biggest financial aid package. You know, I got accepted at Harvard. I went up to Harvard. I said, Harvard, too cold. It's too cold up here, man, in Boston. I was like, no, no, no. So I'm the mayor of the school now. Students hearing they might not graduate, they all turn around. Larry, no, nobody else wanted one. Nobody else is concerned about student council up until that point. Everybody turned around. Larry, what you gonna do about this? So on March the 24th, 1971, I led a walkout at Arts High School. A walkout, a march, and a sit-in. 90% of the students walked out. We marched down to where the board and the union were negotiating, which was the Gateway Hotel, which is now called the DoubleTree Hotel. That's right. A hotel across the street from Penn Station in Newark. There's about 400 of us in the walkout. We marched down. About 200 of us got into the hotel before the hotel even knew what was happening. Like, what's all these black kids doing there? We was off the reservation. We weren't supposed to be downtown, you know. We was right. Off the reservation. What are all these black kids doing down here? And we got up to two of the floors. We sat in, you know, and then Ken Gibson came. Ken Gibson had just been elected mayor of Newark. He was the first African-American mayor in the 300-year history of Newark. And he said, I hear you. I have your demands. If you guys would leave and not get arrested, because all the police was out there and the fire trucks was already out there, they was ready to lock us up. He said, I will make sure that your demands get dealt with. So we believed him, and we left. 3 months after that, April, May, June, about 2 weeks before I was to graduate from Arts High, the mayor's aide, his name was Pete Curtin, came to my house, and he said, the mayor wants to know if you would accept being appointed to the Newark Board of Education, not as a student representative, but as one of the 9 voting members. And I said yes. And on July 1st, 1971, I was sworn in as a board member, and I was the youngest board member, school board member in the history of the United States. And I think I still hold that record because I wasn't even 18 years old.
I beg to differ. Your story will never be short. Number 6.
All right.
How do you plan to respond to take action in light of this decision? And are there any specific initiatives or strategies that you think should be implemented?
And this is regarding the decision on affirmative action. Yes.
Absolutely.
I have already called for on social media. I put up a post this week calling for the impeachment of Supreme Court justices, of the justices that made this decision. Now, these justices are like 9 kings and queens. There's virtually no oversight that of the Supreme Court justices. So, number one, I call for the impeachment of these justices. I put a statement out on social media, but later on this week, I'm going to put out a full release calling for the impeachment and calling for the restructuring of the Supreme Court. We must bring to an end these lifetime appointments. These lifetime appointments make it nearly impossible to shift the court in a reasonable amount of time. These people are appointed for life. They die in office, many of them. And so we need term limits. They should be appointment of maybe, you know, 20 year. Some people say 18 years, but it needs to be a finite number of time. There needs to be a maximum retirement age. They shouldn't stay in there until they die. They should retire. I mean, I could see, going past 70. I'll be 70 in December. I think I still can think and talk, you know. So, yeah, maybe the maximum retirement age would be 80 or something like that. But they should not be lifetime appointments. There should be term limits. There should be staggered terms. There needs to be – the Supreme Court needs to have an ethics code. They don't even have a code of ethics. These guys are out here doing business, getting lavish gifts, getting – paid for vacations from people who have business in front of the court. That's a conflict of interest. So, impeachment and restructuring of the Supreme Court.
What do you think are the most significant arguments raised by those who oppose affirmative action, and how would you counter these arguments?
Well, the significant argument that they raise is that this is reverse discrimination. It's the height of irony that the very parts of the Constitution that the judges upheld in their decision, like the 14th Amendment, which is equal protection of the law, they use that as a justification to end affirmative action. This has been the argument of Chief Justice Roberts for some time. Roberts played a major role in the gutting of voting rights. The Shelby decision a decade or so ago, saying that the racism that the Civil Rights Act attempted to address had no longer exists, that we made enough progress, and now we don't need all these laws. So those are the arguments. And I think the counter argument is that we can show in a myriad of ways that racial inequality still exists, and special measures equal affirmative action that we should take to address this inequality.
In your experience as an activist, are some successful approaches or strategies that have been effective in promoting diversity and inclusion in educational systems? Does that make any sense at all? In your experience as an activist, what are some successful approaches or strategies that have been effective?
Well, I think the what we have seen in college admissions over the past 50 years, shows how effective it's been. One can make an argument that the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Higher Education Act, the Housing Act of 1968, and other civil rights legislation, in fact, made possible the growth and expansion of the black middle class over the past five decades. Literally, millions of black students, other students of color, and poor white students have been able to attend college, and by doing so, get jobs, and by doing so, get jobs that make a middle class lifestyle possible.
And we kind of talked about that at the beginning of the
show.
That's
right. That's right.
Now, how can individuals and communities continue to advocate for affirmative action and work towards equal opportunities despite this decision?
Well, we have to demand it. Now is a time for increased agitation, protest, litigation, economic action, every tool that we have used, and voting. Let us not forget voting, because voting has consequences. Remember, this supermajority that's currently on the court that made this decision, they were all appointed by Republican presidents, by George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., and Donald Trump. Donald Trump got to appoint an unprecedented three Supreme Court justices. We have a presidential election coming up. There should be massive voter registration going on for the next 16, 17 months. And then we need a massive voter turnout like we had in 2020 to reverse this disastrous course that the country is on now.
You kind of answered the question, but looking ahead, what do you believe should be the focus of future efforts to address racial disparities and promote diversity in education, considering the current legal landscape?
Right. Well, I think that those who are in these institutions now who are still committed to diversity must find ways within the scope that is now in existence as a result of these Supreme Court decisions, must find ways to continue the diversification of student bodies, because diversification leads to an enriched educational environment and a more valuable educational experience.
Three people that you actually look up to. Which is not on the list.
Three people. Of course. Let me choose the easiest three. Amiri Baraka, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X.
Out of all the awards that you've ever received, what had an indelible mark on you?
Oh, my goodness.
If any.
I think the award, all the awards were appreciated, all had an impact. But if I was to say something about the award that may have had the most impact, when I was appointed to the Newark Board of Education in August of 1971, I was invited to the Southern Christian Leadership National Convention, which was held in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I received from the hands of Coretta Scott King the Student Leadership Award of SCLC for the Youth Leadership Award from SCLC in 1971.
Thank you very much. That's going to be the last word for this moment, and there will never be a short story. It will always be long, right? Only because it needs to be heard, and that's what's important. I want to thank everyone who tuned in to Quest Youth Radio on 89.5 FM and